Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
For people who live on Nauru, there are very few jobs. For people who live on Nauru, there's very little healthcare, certainly no tertiary hospitals.
Human rights organisations have raised major concerns as reports confirm the first deportations to Nauru under the government's multi-billion dollar offshore deal. Also, we hear the unique story of a new migrant who embraced the country's Fair Go ethos and built his own business from the ground up. And later...
We are wired for connection, and it is mission critical, particularly at a time, as you just said, you know, where everything's changing, to put the effort into organising a catch-up with whether it's old schoolmates or joining new clubs.
End of year 12. Most of us see it as a new chapter in life, and so it should be. But what are some of the ways to navigate the challenges that follow? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, this week saw new heights in federal parliament as deliberations intensified nearing end of year. While Australia's environmental protection reform remains in the spotlight, the Nationals have backflipped on net zero amid mounting discussion on the looming social media ban and more. I spoke with National Radio News political reporter Noah Seckham for deeper insights into Australia's shifting political debates. So I'd like to first of all discuss something that's been on the minds of a lot of people, which is the social media ban coming up in December. Communications Minister Annika Wells announced, from my understanding, midweek that Reddit and Platform Kick will now be included in the ban. Are you able to give us some insight into the response from Shadow Minister Melissa McIntosh?
Well, yeah, Melissa McIntosh has kept up a lot of what we've heard from the coalition so far, where they're not convinced that the government's going to be able to see the bill through and the actual social media ban to completion, which it's due to take effect in just over 1 month. So December 10th is D-Day for this policy. And the main criticism is that we are seeing this list of apps to be banned still being updated at such short notice and quite close to the actual date that it'll take effect. But we did hear from the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, earlier this week, saying that, you know, this list will never be static. It will always change as different platforms develop different technologies and add different features to their products. So we can't expect that every app that's on there now will be on there forever and that others won't be added later. So there's certainly a lot of concern that there won't necessarily be much notice given to parents necessarily.
And, you know, there have been ongoing discussions and pushback from, you know, some advocates as well, especially around vulnerable communities, particularly children with disabilities receiving calls to receive exemptions. Are there any developments here or any insight that you can offer on this component?
Well, it's worth noting that some of the platforms that aren't being included are those messaging first sort of platforms. Something like WhatsApp is being exempted because it's just a messaging site, not a sort of social media platform in its own definition. So the Minister and the eSafety Commissioner have been trying to say that the ban won't be impacting the ability for communities to form and to communicate with each other. It's more this open plane of content and sharing and being exposed to the internet and all sorts. So they're trying to say that this won't impact minorities and groups that really do rely on the internet to connect with each other. But again, it is hard to say at this point.
Moving on to another significant discussion, Australia's national environmental law. So from what I can see, it's been heavily criticised. And Environment Minister Murray Watts talked around this need for delivering a balance between environment and business. Can you elaborate further on what is meant by this?
Well, it's certainly been the minister's view that this act, that the reform to the act that the government has presented in the last week, does strike that balance by it's got the three pillars to it, one of them being streamlining approvals processes. And this was something mentioned in the productivity roundtable a few months ago, which essentially everyone could agree that it's better to get to a yes or a no for a project sooner. So if it's never going to be possible to develop on a certain piece of land because of the environmental consideration, that should be conveyed a lot quicker. So the minister is trying to get that sort of idea across in this bill. The unfortunate thing is that the legislation is made up of about seven different bills and three main parts, and it is over 1,500 pages long. So it's absolutely massive and quite impenetrable, because it is very dry reading, of course, being legislation. And again, we only got this last Thursday. So a lot of the crossbench MPs who are typically, you know, advocating for stronger climate action and environmental protections, they came forward earlier this week saying, we can't support it simply because we don't have time to say that this is a good piece of legislation.
The freedom of information laws, from my understanding, passed the lower house. There were initial concerns around decreased disclosure. How are these further reforms set to impact potentially the public's right to know or broader concerns of transparency?
So yeah, the Freedom of Information Act, as it is essentially a piece of legislation that gives you the right to request access to government-held information. What the government has brought forward, though, is a bill to strengthen it, as they say, which would include introducing a fee for this process, unless you're asking for your own information that the government has. So obviously, journalists, we love talking about ourselves. So a lot of the reporting has been concerned about, you know, the right to information for the media to then get that out.
National Radio News political reporter Noah Seckham speaking with me.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Human rights organisations are deeply concerned, with reports confirming the first deportations to Nauru under a new deal. The government's multi-billion dollar offshore agreement allows the deportation of around 280 non-citizens from the NZYQ group, a cohort living in Australia who had their visas cancelled on character grounds. The deal has been termed as secretive and follows the implementation of recent laws, which come 2 years after these people were released back into the community following a 2023 High Court ruling that they could not be indefinite detention. So what exactly is known about the few that have been exiled? I spoke with Augie Simic, Head of Advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre.
The number of people that could be impacted by recent government changes in law is much broader than just the 280 people that has been talked about in the media. Effectively, the government now has the power to deport anyone who is a non-citizen to any country in the world that they've paid. When probed on this, the department in an inquiry admitted that up to 80,000 people in our community could be impacted. We're incredibly concerned about the laws themselves. When it comes to the deal that's been struck with Nauru, so little is known about what's actually happened. We know that Tony Burke travelled to Nauru without anyone knowing that an agreement has been struck. We know that the cost of that agreement is significant, somewhere between $2.5 billion to $7 billion for the lifetime of the actual deal. We know that there's no cap on the number of people that can be sent to Nauru. And we're incredibly concerned about what happens to people when they get to Nauru.
And just in terms of these law changes, would they now apply to all people seeking asylum?
Yeah, it would apply to anyone who is a non-citizen. So it could be anyone who is seeking asylum, and it could even be a point in time in their asylum journey where for some reason they don't at that point in time have a visa to be in Australia. So like I said, when probed, the Department of Home Affairs admitted that up to 80,000 people could be impacted.
I know you did mention that you don't know too much about these people specifically being deported, but what are some of the risks or concerns around people deported to Nauru?
We know that Nauru is the size of Melbourne Airport. It's a very small island where the conditions are really difficult for people that are living there. For people who live on Nauru, there are very few jobs. For people who live on Nauru, there's very little healthcare, certainly no tertiary hospitals. And given the sort of circumstances that people might be sent in there, there is no support for them. So we were incredibly concerned about the conditions. We also know that there's been an escalation of violence on Nauru towards refugees and people seeking asylum. And there is a history of human rights abuses with the way that the relationship between Australia and Nauru has existed over time, where people arriving by boat have been sent to Nauru. There's a history of human rights abuses.
The government has claimed the moves are a vital step in protection. What's your reaction around this?
We've got a set of circumstances where people are caught up in what has been a political situation. The people who are impacted and are being targeted at the moment are people who have committed an offence previously in their lives. But the reality of the situation is that those people have served a initial sentence for the crimes they've committed. They've then, under Australian law, been re-detained in immigration detention by the Minister of Immigration, not the courts, but the Minister for Immigration has had the power to cancel people's protection findings and re-detain them. The High Court found that people can't be detained in immigration detention definitely. These people have been now part of our community. When they were released in community, some had ankle bracelets put on their legs, and now they've been sent to Nauru. They've been punished so many times already, and now they've been dealt effectively a life sentence with very little information or scrutiny around what's going to happen to them.
Australia's decades-long offshore detention policy has been met with criticism from a number of human rights organisations, with these recent law changes now adding another layer. So in current times, what do you think Australia's perception is when it comes to offshore detention?
We know that Australia's relationship with Nauru has been met with criticism by the international community. Because there's so much secrecy surrounding what's happening, very few people in our community know about Australia's relationship with Nauru.
Augie Simich, Head of Advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, speaking with me.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
So you've just finished year 12 and are stepping into a new chapter in life. It may seem like a big milestone, but what comes next can create some uncertainty and a loss of momentum for some students. The Wire's Thomas Kutis spoke with Dr. Sarah Jefferson, director of the High Achieving Teachers Program at Edith Cowan University, and asked what are the most common challenges students face after finishing year 12?
Well, for most students, even if they're not sitting ASAR exams, you know, if they've followed alternative pathways, for most students, the thing that they really struggle with is that loss of structure. Suddenly, you know, they're not going to a familiar Yes. environment every day, not seeing the faces they used to see, the people they used to interact with. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges they face, is that just their whole life looks completely different to what it did for the previous 12 to 14 years.
Yes, it would be very different with without seeing those same people. And how can they set like some sort of short-term goals to sort of help prevent that sort of post-school slump?
That's such a good question. I think one of the things that applies to fully fledged adults as well is when you've gone through something that big, it's really important to give yourself a bit of permission to have a bit of a slump, to feel a bit uncertain or you know, questioning or a bit flat, and to allow yourself to feel those feelings and acknowledge, yeah, that is okay. I think the thing that is important is that doesn't go on for too long. So you have to have kind of a little bit of a time frame around it. And then you know, that great metaphor about getting back up off the mat. It's time to get back up off the mat.
Something that I have done is maintain those social connections. Tell me, in your opinion, why is that and how is that very important during the transition from school to post-school life?
Look, social connection and, you know, the research tells us this for every single human on the planet is fundamental to our well-being. We are wired for connection and it is mission critical, particularly at a time, as you just said, you know, where everything's changing, to put the effort into organising a catch-up with whether it's old schoolmates or joining new clubs or new activities, volunteering, all of those things. It is, again, as you said before, like social connection is fundamental to our being, even when you are an introvert, even when you kind of, you don't really like people, it's still really important to engage.
You mentioned about physical activity. How much of a role does that play in supporting mental health after finishing such a busy time of schooling life?
Again, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because as often kids can be very consistent about keeping up going to the gym or doing activity and stuff when they're studying. But a lot of the time, you know, that's the first thing to kind of get cancelled when you're studying for an exam and that sort of stuff. So getting back into those good habits again is really important. It doesn't have to be very much. Even 15 minutes, 20 minutes of walking a day is a really good place to start. And of course you can build up from there. But yeah, I'm with you on that one. Physical activity, again, the analogy that we often use is that when you exercise, it's like a painkiller for your brain. So you're actually helping your brain to feel better, and especially at a time when you are feeling a little bit vulnerable or a bit uncertain about where life's going to take you, you want to put all of those things in place to kind of help.
Now, some parents have mentioned to their kids, or even kids in general might have thought of this, that working during like Christmas or, you know, or some sort of volunteer work before waiting for, I don't know, whether they want to do a gap year or whether doing university, how beneficial is that?
Awesome. Can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's really important. It gives young people a sense of purpose.
Yes.
If they've got an actual paying job, it gives them an income, which again, oftentimes those things need to be renegotiated. The bank of mum and dad may cut off the mobile phone funding. Who knows? Parameters can get altered. The alternative is, you know, find your local animal shelter. They're often desperate for volunteers. Go down, look, you know, help with looking after the animals down there. If people aren't really your thing, you know, there's lots of different ways to get involved in the community, to connect and to be, you know, adding value that don't just have to be what everybody else is doing.
Dr. Sarah Jefferson, Director of the High Achieving Teachers Program at Edith Cowan University, speaking with The Wire's Thomas Kutis. When a new migrant arrives in Australia, many love the lifestyle and the opportunity to be given a fair go. Claiborne Figredo is one of the success stories setting up his cleaning business in Melbourne. He arrived in Australia in 1999, along with his now wife. Following a lot of hard work, he opened Cleaning Edge Solutions with just himself as the only employee. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking Mr. Figredo about his journey to Australia.
I came in 99 December with my wife, Sabrina, and we landed in Melbourne, Australia. And within a couple of weeks, I found a job in a factory, in a big company, but on a factory floor. Started working there as an operator there. And after about a year or so, I just felt this was not for me, and decided to start doing something by myself. Like, you know, then I only found that I was able to get a cleaning job and started subcontracting work for a cleaning company. And from there onwards, it got involved in a franchise. I was there for about 8 years in the franchise, as a cleaning franchisee, but going nowhere. So I decided to start up my own business called Cleaning Edge Solutions, and never took any of my ex-clients, even though they were all calling and wanting me back. But I just left and started all by myself with just one contract.
Fantastic. Well done. Congratulations on that, Clavin.
Thank you.
No worries. So why was it so important for you to start a business in Australia, and what motivated you to start?
Yeah, because see, when I was on the factory floor, I had, you know, a lot of people who came to jobs they hated. And it was like, you know, like I just didn't want to end up hating something that I did. I just wanted to get out there and start my own business and be responsible for my own life. So I had to leave the security of a paycheck and go and start something on my own. It wasn't easy. It was very hard. First 3-4 years was very, very hard, very risky, that I had to leave a good paying job and go and start something on my own. So I did it on a part-time basis while I was working. I was cleaning on a part-time basis until I got confident of myself. And that's when I left my job and started my journey in the cleaning industry.
Now, as you know, a lot of migrants, or when we come to Australia, we would like to get a job immediately because it's expensive, especially, you know, international students, new migrants, skilled workers, etc. And so they face a little bit of challenges there. What were the challenges you faced when you started your first business?
The challenge we have faced is first when we came in, like, you know, banks were not willing to give you a loan. You were not able to get a credit card. Because you had no credit history. And those are the major challenges that I had. I did plan to start a business, but then it was a slow burn. Like, you know, it normally doesn't happen straight away. First five years, I would say, was very difficult. I had to sacrifice, my wife and I had to sacrifice holidays and weekends. I had to put in a lot of effort. In 2003, my eldest son was born, and they've got 4 kids, and my wife was a stay-at-home mom. It wasn't easy. It was very challenging. Only after about, say 5-6 years of hard work, dedication, commitment, and determination saw me through that rough patch. Like that's when I think that first 3-4 years, a lot of people give up because it's too tough.
Well, you've started your business, and you mentioned that you continued with some other business. So now you have established the Figueredo Group, providing support to different businesses. How did you realize you had to diversify across the sectors?
It was good that I had to do that, because I was started off in commercial cleaning, and I did not have any experience in food production cleaning, like meat shops and abattoirs. There was a cleaning company that was selling. They had about 18 stores across Melbourne, that butcher shops that they were cleaning. That was my first big risk that I took. So when I went to the bank manager, the manager said, "Clavin, if you fail in this business, you will lose your house and your investment property. You have no experience cleaning butcher shops. What makes you confident, think that you can do it?" I said, "Look, that's the risk I'm willing to take," I said. And eventually that one decision led me into the food production business, and we are now cleaning some of the biggest facilities in Australia. And during COVID, by me diversifying, during COVID, all the other commercial space went quiet, but the food production was booming.
Founder of Cleaning Edge Solutions, Clavin Figueredo, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show, brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Nyangin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.